This is Purple Radio on demand.
What do I say? Hi, I'm Claire. I'm Claire.
I think we'll do. How do we want it?
Tell me what you want.
Hi, I'm Sam.
And I'm Louis.
And we welcome you back to another episode of Chalkboard Ultra, investigating some of the most interesting problems in all of mathematics.
What are we doing today, Sam?
Today we have yet another special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Claire Wallace. I'm an assistant professor in the maths department.
Very nice. And
what do you do?
What do I do? This term I'm teaching math finance, the third year course, and next term I will be lecturing single maths B for physics, chemistry and biology students.
Ooh.
In between, I do a whole lot of tutorials and a whole lot of marking.
What is math finance exactly?
What is math finance? Math finance, at Durham at least, is the study of probability models that underpin our understanding of how the financial world would work in a completely different world. I've had it described as, imagine everybody is doing astrology, right? Everybody's just out there doing astrology to make their financial decisions. And
you mean like the zodiac astrology?
Zodiac astrology. And I teach an astronomy course where we learn how to use telescopes to look at stars. If you understand how that works, you're probably going to have a slightly better job of doing the zodiac stuff, but it doesn't really entirely correlate. So what we do is we pretend that the financial markets follow a purely probabilistic system where everything is predictable and moves according to the rules of maths, and we see what we can say about it. In reality, none of that is quite true. Supply and demand, and also things like people shorting GameStop stock for memes mean that none of the models we use really apply.
I absolutely love that analogy.
It's the best one I've heard in a really long time, yeah.
That's great.
When looking up things like math finance, I see the words Brownian motions, Black-Scholes equations, stochastic differential equations. Are they actually related to finance? Or?
Yeah, so the Black-Scholes formula was developed, discovered by Black-Scholes and Merton as an attempt to describe how financial models should behave if you take the fundamentally chaotic human part out of them and just left the randomness. If you assume that share prices behave like Brownian motion, then the Black-Scholes formula helps us to price options in financial markets.
Well, I remembered Brownian motions from physics. It was always talking about the randomness of particles, but I never thought they had a financial aspect to it.
So this all comes down to basically the central limit theorem, which Stats 1 fans will remember as the theorem that tells us that whenever you take an average of lots of small bits of randomness, the resulting noise that you're left with usually has a normal or Gaussian distribution. Brownian motion we can think about as the trajectory version of that. So if we look at a share price moving along in time and you picture drawing the graph, there are lots of small forces that are bringing randomness into this. And when you average those all out, you get something that works like a normal distribution. So if you take the difference between the height of Brownian motion at any two points in time, that difference has a normal distribution with mean zero, and the variance is the time you waited.
I was also going to ask about stochastic differential equations. Now, I know my friend Sam here loves his differential equations.
He's but then I hate the word stochastic because that's too much statistics for me. But
what exactly is it? Because the whole thing of DEs is very physics-y, I'd argue. And then you got stochastic added in front of it. What exactly are they, and how useful are they in the world of financial analysis?
So a stochastic differential equation is what you get when you take a differential equation and you add in noise. So my best
well, we already talked about the sound. Can you hear the sound of a drum? Noise?
Yeah, noise in the sense of an error. Noise in the sense of,
you know, so like perturbations?
Perturbations, yeah. So you write your differential equation in the formula dst equals something dt, And then you add in Brownian motion because maybe your measurement of DST has an error in it. And you don't know what that error looks like, but you think it's probably sort of normally distributed at any point in time.
And then so that's accounting for error.
You try to build a framework that allows for, we've got this deterministic bit where we understand what's going on and it looks like a differential equation, but we've also got this randomness to account for in the system.
Hmm. Is it in some way related to statistical mechanics? Or am I still thinking in physics-y mode? I think I am.
You are.
Brownian motion does come up in statistical mechanics. The stuff I worked on in my thesis was proving that if you take a very specific statistical mechanics model and you zoom in on a part of a boundary in the right way, then you get something that looks like Brownian motion. Unfortunately, I did all the probability theory behind this to prove that this would work. And then the bit where you start with the statistical mechanics model and prove that it fits the probability setup I had just never happened because of COVID. No. So I have this beautiful, huge piece of probability that says that if you start off with something that fits these really specific conditions, then you end up with a function that looks like Brownian motion that's got all this cool stuff going on. And we think it connects to this thing in the easing model, and I just never did that step.
Have you considered like retaking that step and just trying to do it again?
I had some funding to be a postdoc and work on this, but I was also offered a teaching fellow job at Durham.
Okay.
And they were both at Durham, actually. I realized that I really loved teaching. And, you know, I wrote my PhD thesis in lockdown.
Right.
It was a grim 18 months.
Yeah, that's not nice.
And given the choice between continuing it, doing this stuff for another year or focusing on teaching for a bit, I thought, well, I'll focus on teaching for a bit and I can come back to it. And then I never looked back.
I suppose you just had a bit of a negative view over it because all you could think about while being stuck inside was this thesis and you just didn't want to go back to it because that's all you knew, I suppose.
Yeah. Writing a thesis is always rough, right? There is always a bit at the end. And it's similar with a project, but on a smaller scale. You spend 4 years of your life thinking about this maths, and then you spend, you know, maybe the last 6 months of that writing it up, and you are just trying to get 150 pages of maths to be perfect. There is always going to be a really horrible 6 months at the end of it. I can't recommend adding in COVID lockdowns to that.
I'm really regretting thinking about doing academics now. That sounds like a lot.
I don't want to put you off, but as you do your final year project, and particularly as you do the end bit, think about, could I spend 3 years doing this? Just this.
Just the project. I'm sure I'll come back to that in about a year's time and reevaluate everything. I'm sure it'll be fine. Yeah.
So what are you doing for your final year supervising project then?
So currently I'm supervising 10 students on how do we learn maths. We are reading a bunch of papers from the intersection of education theory, sociology, psychology, and maths, looking into different approaches to maths learning, different things that can surprise us about the best way to learn maths. I say I have 10 students. I'm sharing my 10 students with another staff member. Traditionally, you get 5 students in total, either all third years or a mix of third and fourth years.
It does seem a lot to kind of look after 10 students and get 10 different people to, I don't know, write different dissertations on the same topic.
We've got a lot of sort of subtopics going on. We've got people thinking about the order in which you practice problems and how that helps, whether cramming versus continuous study can be helpful. We've got a lot of different topics to offer people. A big one is moving from school to university, because that's such a big change in the way you have to learn, the way you have to think about maths.
Yeah.
We want you to start becoming independent learners and like viewing yourself as the person who's driving the car. We're just giving you the tools. So there's a lot in there that people are talking about.
That's really interesting. But I would have thought that's more of a psychological thing. So are there any math techniques that you use? I don't know, something that comes to my mind is something like decision theory. Would you use that to find out the best, so a so-called best technique for learning maths?
There is a lot of statistics in these papers.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of these papers do is set up an experiment, quite often with school kids, but sometimes we're looking for the papers that have undergraduates in them. And they, you know, they have a control group and they do this big statistical test and then they do a bunch of statistical analysis. I haven't come across any decision theory being used, but I like the idea.
Okay, well, you can take that one back to your students.
Yeah, I will do.
Was this your idea then to do the maths or how we learn maths?
It was actually a module that I suggested to the department that we should look into running in future, but there wasn't space for it to happen this year. And so I'm running it as a project instead so that we can sort of see what topics come up, see how students react to it. Yeah. And then once we've got space to put it in the module list, we're going to be so ready.
What's the end goal of this project? Is it to encourage maths engagement, or is it more about the education side of mathematics?
It's about the education side. It's about thinking about what approaches learners of maths should be taking to give them the best chance at succeeding, especially in somewhere like Durham where we ask so much of our students.
Yeah.
Are there any other projects that you've supervised before or are hoping to supervise?
So I did put in a fourth year project this year, which isn't running because I've got so many students on the third year project, which was about the 6 degrees of separation phenomenon and small worlds models in random graphs.
Ooh, I've heard a lot about that.
Me too, yeah.
What's that all about?
So it's the idea that everyone's got more mutuals with each other than you realise. This thing where you go to a party and you run into somebody who you have no reason to know, but it turns out that, like, their boyfriend plays hockey with your housemate or something. The idea that society and networks of social connections are so much more interconnected than we realise.
Have you seen something like that yourself, actually applying those things of, oh, I've just read about this in my little book.
My little book.
I have a question.
What book have you got there?
I don't know. I had a list of questions that.
I mean, yeah, Durham's a really small town, right? As far as the student population is concerned, is a small town in that everyone knows everyone. But also, as a local, Durham is not a big place. I cannot go anywhere with my parents without running into at least someone that one of them has worked with. The focus of the small worlds model is not so much the idea that you would run into people in your hometown and have a mutual friend with them. It's more that it takes surprisingly few links to connect you to somebody on the other side of the world who you ostensibly have nothing in common with.
I think the place where most people go when they think about this is like, oh, we actually are really close to people like celebrities or the royal family or thing. But it's not just about that. It's about, I don't know, some random school teacher in Connecticut who I would have no idea how to get there, but there is actually a certain number of separations between us. How did that even begin to formulate? How is there a number being put on that?
And also, why is it six? Why is it some sort of perfect number for this degrees of freedom?
So six is not actually the perfect number.
Ooh.
They reckon it's about 6.6, having done a whole bunch of network analysis recently. This all started with some sort of urban legend conversation that was going around. It was the title of a play. And then Stanley Milgram, whose name you might recognize from those
Milgram's
horrendous experiments.
Oh, I've not heard about this.
It's horrendous, it's horrific. You would basically get volunteers in and to press these buttons, and each button would inflict pain on a test subject. It was completely fake, but it was all about authority, all about at what point, because you could hear these people in pain, at what point would you eventually say, look, I can't do this, I know I've got to follow orders, but I can't keep putting this person through pain. It was designed to see just how willing people would be to stop. I mean, I didn't know he was connected. I mean, I know we're talking about 6 degrees, but I didn't know that he was connected to this.
Yeah, so this experiment, they would be shown a person being asked questions, and every time they got a question wrong, the volunteer would be told to press the button. And it would just be like a friendly man with a clipboard being like, yep, and again, please. And people would go along with it. Big fan of a dodgy experiment in the 60s. He also did this experiment where he got a bunch of people and he says, here's an envelope addressed to someone in Boston. I want you to send this to the person you know who you think is most likely to be able to get this envelope to this person in Boston.
Okay.
Right.
The postman.
Well, yeah.
You think. But I imagine you can't just put it into a postbox, stamp it and go. You have to actually hand it to this person who I imagine you're on at least a first name basis with.
Yeah, exactly. You want to be on at least a first name basis with someone and then ask them to do the same thing. And in the 60s, no one had a phone.
Mm.
People were very willing to get involved in something like this. And so they, you know, did these chains and they tracked how many times the envelope had been passed on. And they found that on average, it took 6 goes to get from your random person to someone in Boston.
Right. And was this done all over the world or was it just from one specific place to Boston?
That is an excellent question, because it turns out a third of the people he gave the original envelopes to were in Boston to start with.
That just damages the experiment.
It absolutely damages the experiment. He did send a bunch of them to random people in Nebraska, but I read a book about this, and the authors just cite this woman realizing that actually, this experiment is super flawed, and we've all been basing our 6 degrees of separation on this experiment. Where,
and so, and it's not been done since.
So, Duncan Watts and Stephen Strogatz, who came up with the small world model, and wrote this excellent book that I've been reading, tried it again in the 90s, but they did it with emails, and this has 2 flaws. One is that in the 90s. The sort of person who has access to emails is probably quite well connected with everybody else who has access to emails, because
right.
That is not a big section of the population in the 90s. But the other one comes back to what you were saying about I wouldn't know where to start about finding it. Because with an email, you can forward it on to everyone you know. And so...
But that's not really allowed, because that's...
That's a different question.
That's a different question.
Right? That's doing a completely different kind of search around your network, because now if you're sending it out to everyone and they're sending it out to everyone,
there's a multiplication of networks. It just doesn't work.
There's such a big multiplication of the number of paths compared to here is one envelope, give it to one person.
Because it is actually a much smaller number. If you think there's 8 billion people on the planet now, if you're talking about this 6 degrees of separation, I think it's only 45 people. You have to send it to 45 people, and then every one of those have to send it to 45 new people. You get 45 to the power of 6, and that surpasses 8 billion. So you only need those number of people to get everywhere. It's insane.
I would think that with the information age, this sort of thing would just break down, because the connections between people, they've expanded. You've got things like Facebook and Instagram and
LinkedIn, yeah. That's all about
LinkedIn,
connection.
Literally, yeah.
LinkedIn is all about connection. It shows you everyone that's a 1, 2, or 3 graph distance away from you.
If only it did 4, 5, and 6 as well.
So you could actually see. But then you would just get everyone in the world. So is there any reason to suggest that this number is diminishing then? Because we say 6. You've just told us 6.6, which is a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, sure, that number will decrease because of the information age.
It all depends on your definition of connected.
Right.
Right. One of the things that the early people thinking about friendship networks really struggled with was that nobody can agree on what being friends is. There are probably plenty of people who you consider a friend who do not consider you a friend.
Yes.
Or the other way around. And also, like, at what point does the person that you sort of nod at in the corridor make it into the team of friends?
I've heard there's this thing that you only really have 150 friends. Is this related to it? Or maybe not?
Yeah, possibly. Like, there are plenty of people I follow on Twitter that I don't consider friends and that definitely don't follow me back.
Yeah, but you know of them. But so has it got to be a two-way correspondence? And could you be maybe acquaintances? So I know a lot of people in my lectures. They're not my friends per se, but I would happily talk to them because we have something in common, so I'm acquainted with them. Mm. Does that count?
I think it comes back to the thing about passing a letter on to people.
Yeah.
Who right. do you know who you can trust to continue the chain?
Okay.
Who would take the letter from you? There are plenty of people I follow on Twitter, and if I ran up to them in the street brandishing an envelope, their security guards would have me flattened before I got close, right?
That is true.
Yeah, so the thing about having lots of acquaintances within a lecture is a really interesting point, because one of the big features of small world networks or models is that what we tend to see is that within a group of people, everyone will be friends with everyone, right? You get these small clusters where everybody knows each other, but then also people know one person somewhere else that nobody else knows, right? So maybe you're in a lecture with 80 people, you all could put each other down and you probably all would put everybody in that room.
Yeah.
But then you will have a housemate that takes it, that's on a different course. And so that lets you connect to a completely different group of people. And that's how the paths end up being so short, because people tend to know almost seemingly random people that are completely disconnected from everybody else that they're in a group with.
But it's just because they have that one connection with someone that just leads them to the whole new connections.
Is there any difference between what I think you mentioned, network theory, and graph theory? Because it's all about connectedness, edges,
nodes, people,
degrees.
So a network theory is this big sort of interdisciplinary project between mathematicians and computer scientists and sociologists and engineers, all of whom realized that they needed an understanding of how networks work to be able to get on in their disciplines. But actually, the only way you can understand any or all of it is by using sort of bringing graph theory in from maths, but also understanding the social side of it and the power structure from sociology. The physicists showed up because they always do.
Stealing the glory.
Apologies.
This I've been reading a book by Duncan Watts, who came up with the small world model, describing like the story of how it came about. And he describes the physicists as basically locusts, hearing there's a problem that needs solved and coming in and being like, we'll help. And
but then proceed to help in no way.
Do. Oh, do they? Yeah, they usually do. But the physicists will sort of descend on a problem, just arrive.
Like a swarm.
This reminds me a lot of Erdős, and I've just heard that name a lot. Maybe not with the 6 degrees, but with the whole connections thing, mm-hmm. and the fact that everyone has their own Erdős number. What exactly is that?
So an Erdős number is a way of thinking about your graph distance from the root of a graph, where the edges represent publishing scientific papers together. So if you drew a graph where every vertex was a scientist, mm-hmm. and you put an edge between any two scientists who published together, and you consider Erdős as the root of the graph, he has distance 0, then you calculate what's the minimum number of steps you have to take to get from a scientist to make it back to Erdős.
Okay.
So everyone who wrote a paper with Erdős has an Erdős number of 1.
Yep.
Everyone who wrote a paper with one of them has an Erdős number of 2. You keep working outwards.
And so on and so forth. And in the same way, is there a limit to that? Like, can you always get yourself, if you've published a paper, can you get yourself back to Erdős in 6 papers? Or is that like not the same?
Maybe the average amount for all doctors in the world.
Yeah.
It would be 6. Or 6.6.
According to a website, which I've completely forgotten what it's called, the median Erdős number across people with a finite Erdős number is 5, and the highest known Erdős number is 13.
Okay.
I think it's like the Erdős number project, maybe.
But in the same way to Erdős is the idea of Kevin Bacon.
And it's exactly the same thing, yeah.
It's the same. So everyone's got a Bacon number based on how many films they've done, is that right?
Yeah, so this was a group of 3 college students in the 90s who came up with this hypothesis that Kevin Bacon is the center of the universe, on the basis that he seemed to have been in a lot of films with a lot of different people, and they would sit around in their dorm rooms and try to come up with the shortest possible connection between an actor and Kevin Bacon based on having been in films together. So almost anyone on IMDb who's been in a film will have a finite Bacon number. There are a relatively small number of people who have finite Erdős and finite Bacon numbers. And there is a thing of adding them together to get your Erdős Bacon number.
That's insane.
There's also Sabbath numbers, which is your distance from Black Sabbath in musical
the band,
collaboration. Yeah. And about 3 people have finite Erdős Bacon Sabbath numbers, one of which is Natalie Portman.
She's got like the smallest Erdős Bacon Sabbath number.
Yeah. Because she is a scientist, actress, and singer.
That is incredible.
Right. When the researchers were working on small world models, again, in the early 90s, they didn't have access to a lot of big data structures. So they went to a scientific paper repository and said, you know, we know that you've got details of who's collaborated with who. Would you send us some information? And they said, yeah, if you send us one name, we'll charge you $50 to send you all the details of everyone they've collaborated with, and another $50 for the next level, and another $50 for the next level. And these two researchers were like, I don't think you appreciate what that third $50 is going to entail in terms of work for you.
Oh my God.
But they decided that that was a no-go. And the second place they looked was the Kevin Bacon game, because there was a website by this point listing minimum numbers and connections of all these different actors. And so they contacted these three college students and were like, would you give us your database? And they were like, sure. So the theory of small world models really just come out of the Kevin Bacon game.
That's amazing.
I found out that according to some analysis by Facebook, the average distance between any two random Facebook users is 4.5.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's less than 6.
It is less than 6. So that would support your idea that
it's diminishing over time because of information.
Yeah. But then there are areas where people are really not connected to the internet and not using Facebook, right? And so you've got to sort of counterbalance that we've got this extremely connected set of people who are very online, but that's not really reaching everybody.
So there's the idea of you can diminish it using social media. So like on Facebook, you get yourself down to 4.5 in terms of passing letters to each other, 6.6. Can you like take away any of forms of media and just say talking to people or actually traveling somewhere? And does that number go higher? Is there a thing of looking the other way around?
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
Because even by the 90s, by the time Watson Strogatz were hoping to recreate Milgram's original experiments, they were like, clearly we'll just use the internet. But they got a 0.4% success rate of reaching their random person in Boston through sending all those emails out.
Well, because email probably wasn't as much of a prevalent thing then. Or
because people just delete them.
They thought it was a spam email.
Well, you know, you start getting loads of emails, right? If in the 60s, if you receive a letter from a friend of yours saying like, oh, I'm playing this game, would you pass this envelope on to somebody
else? That's the peak of your day, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the best thing that's going to happen to you. You don't have Twitter. But by the 90s, people are getting loads of emails. People are becoming a bit more jaded about email. And so they think a lot of people just sort of ignored them.
Oh, sad.
Would you say then that the 6 degrees of freedom has no real purpose now? Or are there still applications that we as mathematicians can use?
It's really, really important. Understanding how people are connected was a massive thing in COVID, right? Modeling the spread of disease from one group of people to another.
I didn't even think of that.
Really relies on understanding how people come into contact with each other. To what extent do you need to lock the country down to prevent this disease from getting into nursing homes, hospitals, that sort of thing?
Right.
If the distance between your average patient in a hospital and your average sort of 8-year-old that's running around licking things is not very high, then you've got to do quite a lot to damp down the spread of a disease. So things like this are really important in things like disease modeling. They also really accurately represent how neurons are connected in our brains.
Math bio, Sam.
I'm just trying to think.
We love it.
It turns out the randomness that describes the way people make friends with other people is also a pretty good description for the way that different neurons end up connected in different areas of our brains. In both cases, we end up with similar behavior in that certain vertices become hubs where everything's connected to that one. And so you can think of it like transport hubs, right? If you want to get anywhere from Durham, you are flying from Newcastle to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And then flying on, because Amsterdam is the connection. And this also sort of works with people and friendships, but it really works with neurons. And so all the models that describe small world networks can be applied to neural networks and understanding how connections form in our brains. Also power lines.
Power lines?
There was a massive blackout across America caused by like 3 minor power lines tripping, because it turned out everywhere was super connected. And as soon as you took out simultaneously a small number of connections, the alternative route got overloaded by not very many things being knocked out. And then when that was overloaded, the next one along got knocked out. and it caused a blackout that rolled from west to east across America from like four lines going down because a tree fell over.
So it just puts a whole new perspective on your perception of how
connected everything in the world is.
Exactly, yeah. It's still strange to see it actually in practice, though, and you don't realize how close we all are. I was in America this summer, and, well, two of the people I was most friends with, one of them was from Australia. So I was like, wow, that's really cool. I'm meeting people from all over the world. And the other person who I met in Pennsylvania lives in a town that's 10 minutes from me.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is weird.
Is that a product of randomness, or is it not random?
Is it coincidence? Is it? Well, it has to be. It is coincidence.
It is definitely coincidence.
But,
or is it something that the 6 degrees would say, well, it's inevitable. It will happen that a friend of a friend, someone that you know, something near you, it's going to happen eventually.
What took you to America?
Oh, Camp America.
Were they also on Camp America?
Yes, but I didn't know them before.
Mm. Right, but Camp America has a reasonably small audience, right? You have to be in quite a specific age group to be interested.
It has to be a specific age group, a specific kind of area in your life. Camp America is just the agency that help you get to America. Mm-hmm. And in America, there are thousands of summer camps you can work at. And we weren't even in the same department in the camp.
Mm.
So I was working in a STEM department at camp, and she was doing arts. And so we're not even connected on a level. She has different work to me. We lead different lives, interested in different things, but we live in a town that's close to each other. So why did that bring us there? Does that say that if I went to any of the other camps, I would have found someone as close? Or is that just...
Maybe if you took a mean of the bunch of different camps that you would go to, maybe it would suggest something. It could be 6, it could be 6.6.
Yeah. It could be a very expensive experiment if I wanted to do that.
Can I suggest that there are loads of people doing Camp America? And if you did a bit of a birthday paradox calculation and thought about the number of people who meet people, the number of meetings that happen at Camp America.
Yeah. There's got to be someone there.
It's only 20. Was it 23 people at a minimum? And
there's a 50% chance that
they'll share a birthday.
Yeah. On this camp that had 600 people, I shared a birthday with one person. There were some days where no one had a birthday, and then some days where 5 people had the same birthday, but I only had one birthday twin on that camp.
I tried this out in a single math B tutorial last year.
Oh, there
were 15 of us in the room, and we had 2 pairs of matching birthdays. But I have a better birthday paradox.
Go ahead.
Story. We love our paradoxes.
We do.
The other weekend, I was at Maths Jam, which is a maths communication, maths in public sort of conference. I was there with Team Chalkdust, and I brought 180 packets of Skittles, because on the back of every packet of Skittles is written the words, "No two rainbows are the same, neither are any two packs of Skittles.
Oh wow.
Enjoy an odd mix." And these are the sort of trick-or-treat size ones, right? So they've got 16 or 17 Skittles in each. This was a room with 150 maths nerds in it, so I did the maths. There are fewer than 11,000 possible ways you can break down a packet of 16 or 17 Skittles into 5 colours. If you do the birthday paradox on this, you only need to open 120 packets to get a better than 50% chance
of getting 2 that are the same.
Of getting 2 that are the same. And I was presenting to a room of 150 people who are into maths communication.
150?
That's amazing.
Were they all your friends, Claire?
They are now.
So you gave them all Skittles and they said, no, who's got a match?
I had a Google form.
Fill
in the number of each.
So was this your lightning talk?
This was my lightning talk.
Oh my God.
Got up 5 minutes. I brought enough Skittles for everybody, right? Only about half of them got entered into the spreadsheet. Quite a few of them are in my office, but there were definitely some people who were just eating sweets and not putting them in my spreadsheet.
How dare they?
But 72 was enough to find a match. We did find 2 people who had the same breakdown of Skittles.
Wow.
Which was only, at 72, there was only a 20% chance of us finding a match.
The power of probability. Well, I think that's been a very enlightening talk we've had. Thank you ever so much, Claire.
That's all right.
Join us next time as we delve deeper into the wonders of mathematics. We'll see you next week.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram as well. Keep safe.
And keep well. This is a question I wanted to ask as well, because in our first episode of this, we talked a lot about the infinite monkey theorem, which has got lots and lots to do with randomness. Can we actually ever reach true random behavior? Because this Brownian motion, I assume, it just simulates random behavior. Is true random a possible thing? Or is that a bit too of a philosophical question to ask?
I think theoretical randomness and simulation of randomness, what you're trying to get at is the fact that theoretical randomness and simulated randomness are two different things.
Right.
So whenever you look at a sample path of Brownian motion that's been generated by a computer, they've taken a random seed and used it to generate that. And that's never truly random. It's pseudo-random. If we used the same seed again, we'd get the same sample path.
Mm-hmm.
But things can be truly random, I do think. Rolling a dice can be truly random if you do it right.
We did try that. We did try that at the end of the Infinite Monkey one.
Because I actually rolled a dice.
I do have a pair of dice. Well, not a pair. A bunch of dice on me. Just in case. You never know. You never know. There could be a podcast.
Just in case what?
You might say about rolling a die and...
Well, it came up in that case. Have you ever had to use it?
No. And there's always
carry around dice with them just in case.
I'm dice man.
Just in case you see snakes and ladders and no one's brought dice with them.
Exactly. There's an example. Many a time people have lost dice. Not that I've stolen them.
They are always the thing that goes missing in board games. In my parents' house, we had a load of games with no dice and then 6 dice separately that just sort of travelled around. Whichever one you got out, you'd have to go and find like the little box with the dice in it.
I love that.
Because they all went missing. Presumably, Louis had them all in his pocket.
Indeed,
you know,
I did. I prefer the 1 to 6, but I'm partial to a...
Do you have a favourite die?
The 20-sided die is always a nice thing, but you never know. There could be other ones, 1 to 6, 1 to 12, 1 to 100.
Hmm.
I don't know what game includes 1 to 100. Have you ever heard of the Wiki game?
Yes.
Does that utilize the 6 degrees?
Very much, yes.
So the Wiki game...
Well, you don't know how to stop. That's the problem. You'll just dive deep. And
I do. I go wiki diving too much. The Wiki game, then, this is where you start at a Wikipedia article or you start from the search page and you have to get to any other article that you choose or someone chooses. And... obviously, there's the game you can try your best and you'll just click random links until you get there. That takes a while. Or you could optimize it and, I don't know, find the exact link. Do we know the number of exact optimizations or are there just too many articles to do that?
So there is a page on Wikipedia dedicated to the Wiki game. It's got some suggested long paths.
Yeah.
So there's a Wikipedia page for some bacteria that seemingly is the worst connected page because all of the longest paths either start or end with this. But the way to do it is always to go via a hub, right? You want to get to, like, Europe, and then you can get down to where you want to be quite quickly because Europe is a well-connected page.
Oh, the actual page rather than the place.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and, of course, you can't search for it as well, which limits you. Yeah. Of course, there's different variations. 2-player game, 5 clicks to
the
Jesus.
Race.
Time trials.
5 clicks to Jesus, so you need to get to Jesus in 5 clicks.
It can be done. That's the thing, that depending on which random article you get, you probably will be able. I mean, it's only 1 less than 6.
All right.
You could probably do it.
Here's a homework task. There'll be a wiki article on chalk, right? Start there and get to Jesus and tell me the exact path you have to go to.
Chalk, Western Europe, Christendom, Jesus.
I just want to know where Western Europe came up in chalk.
Chalk is common throughout Western Europe. I clicked on Western Europe. Medieval Christendom.
But chalk is common everywhere.
A very short hop to Jesus.
I would like to edit that wiki article and say that chalk is just relevant everywhere.
But it's commonly found as a deposit in Western Europe.
Purple Radio Podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.